Well, now, we're making a record, Commander McMillan, of your answer to questions I'd like to ask about details of your equipment and your technique on the Peary Polar Expedition. It's important to the organization I work for because we're trying to lighten the weight of the soldier. And he had, at the present time, all the equipment he has to carry, the Arctic Trooper, is so very, very heavy that something drastic must be done. Well, I recall in my, just in the back of my memory, that your expedition, Peary's expedition, had slept in the clothing without a sleeping bag. So, thinking to find all we can about this, we looked into it, and so far as we've been able to find to date, yours is the only expedition which, as a standard operating procedure, slept at night in your clothing without a sleeping bag. Now, of course, there are many expeditions became benighted and had to go for some days sleeping without bags. I've done it myself in some places. But as far as I know, your expedition is the only one which has a standard operating procedure organized to sleep at night without bags. And first of all, am I correct about that, or can you think of any other expedition which ever...
No, I know of no expedition that's ever tried to do cold work. I mean 60 and 70 below zero.
Uh-huh.
Without a sleeping bag at night. They all use sleeping bags.
Well, I have a great many questions here. Some we went over yesterday, and you pointed out that in Peary's book, Secrets of Polar Travel, much of this could be found, so I won't undertake to repeat what we know is in that book, but rather to get your reaction to some of what we think may be leading questions on this. I'm going to make them somewhat at random here, because what I want to do is I have certain questions to which I would like to get the answer, but I'm also seeking to stimulate your memory, and any comments that come to you, any reactions, any thoughts on the subject of how you succeeded in traveling so lightly, and in the technique of sleeping without sleeping bags, would be interesting. The first question I'll start with, I recall yesterday you told me that the thing that you lay down on after you fixed your clothing, you explained to me about your feet and so forth. We can go into that later on, but when you laid down on a piece of canvas only. And I thought about that quite a good deal, and wondering why you didn't get cold through the canvas, because we get the impression that the pressure points where your shoulders and your hips touch are very, very important, and a little bit more of insulation, a little extra insulation there compared to what you have on the rest of your body could do quite a bit.
Yeah, we didn't really need the canvas, I think, because the dogs sleep right out in the snow, 60 and 70 below zero. Peary maintains, you know, that the animals that live up there all sleep down in the snow, as we did. And we really didn't need that strip of canvas on the snow bed. We simply put it in under us. I don't remember what I ever did with it. I think I just threw it away. I don't remember using that strip of canvas. But I remember Peary giving me a strip of canvas to lie on at night after we had built our snow house. He said, put that on the snow bed, just lie on that canvas. Got to protect your body from the snow. But I don't think we ever used it. I can't remember using it.
Is this because the fur is such a good insulator? I remember yesterday you spoke quite a bit about the polar bear fur being better than caribou, in fact, better than anything that you knew. And was it the very fine insulating qualities of the polar bear fur to which you attribute your ability to sleep in the snow, or just a little bit of canvas?
Well, you know, really, I do not know whether a polar bear skin is more impervious, you might say, to cold than caribou skin. But I know that polar bear pants, because of the fact that it's almost impossible to wear them out, they're more durable. Where caribou skin breaks off, each hair, you might say, having a hole in it. But polar bear skin, you can do anything with it at all, and it's like a wall. Nothing ever came through polar bear skin. In fact, I can't remember the wind ever blowing through our capitas. Caribou skins, mm-hmm. for that matter. And a caribou skin may be just as warm as polar bear skin, but of course you couldn't wear caribou skin. You'd simply rip them all to pieces in your work. Mm-hmm. That was one reason why we have the polar bear skin. That's all the reason why the Eskimos of the far north all use polar bear skin pants. They never use reindeer skin pants.
I'm going to ask you a question at this point, if I may. It's a very hard one, but if an answer could be found, it would certainly be the $64 answer to an important question. Now, obviously, polar bear fur is not available in any more than very limited quantities, a few hundred bear at most a year, so it's not feasible, obviously, to equip a whole army or even a small army of troops with polar bear fur. Do you have any thoughts at all on the subject of a substitute that might be satisfactory artificial one, I mean, some kind of a textile or fabric that you've ever had experience with which at all approximates it?
No, we used, on my 1913-17 trip, I got the warmest clothes I could buy from Abercrombie & Fitch in New York City. And they were supposed to be impervious to cold. But the trouble with all of these clothes which we took from home was that the condensation from the body turns into ice on the inside of the clothes. And we threw them away. We never used them at all.
And it doesn't do that in fur clothing?
No, never in fur clothing. We never had any condensation inside of our caribou skin coats or inside of our polar bear skin pants. Of course, as I told you yesterday, we were wearing union suits, underclothing, in under our furs.
And that we're very much interested in. Could I sort of prod you a little bit on a point that's of great interest to us, the fact that Stephenson, who has the utmost respect for your methods, and I see in your book and in your series of writings that the feeling is mutual. Nevertheless, there is this difference, I noticed, that Stephenson says that he always used only fur clothing and no textile whatever. However, he did sleep in sleeping bags for comfort.
Well, I'll tell you, Stephenson used caribou skins. It must be very comfortable to travel along with a caribou skin, the skin next to your body, like the fawn skin, the skin of the younger caribou. And I think that would easily take the place of our underclothes. But we didn't have those thin fawn skins for underclothing. And we sewed...
I mean, they just weren't up there. They just weren't up there.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So we put on these... Well, I think they were woolen union suits, and they absorbed perspiration. And so we were always comfortable if we could keep dry. But the Eskimos of Baffin's Land, as you know, do use fawn skin underclothes. But it would be impossible to walk very far in polar bear skin pants without some kind of a covering between the pants and the body.
And that's why you have it, I see.
Yeah, that's to prevent chafing.
I see.
From long walking.
And do I recall that yesterday you said that when you exerted yourselves very extensively, such as pulling on fighting sledges through rough ice, you would sweat during the day, those days, and this would be a problem. It would make you cold at night, and you'd shiver at night. Did you tell me?
Yeah, that was the objection. For we that were working hard, not being able to keep up with the Eskimos, you see, worked so hard, in fact, that we perspired even at 60 below zero, and our underclothes sometimes were almost wringing wet, and at night we'd shiver and shake, trying to dry out our underclothes with the heat of our body. But if we were careful to loosen up the capita, the deerskin coat, and let the air circulate in under that, between that and our body, more than we did, I think we could have avoided that. But of course, at 60 and 70 below zero, we wanted to keep as warm as possible. The result was, at times, running behind the dog teams, we became overheated. That's when we suffered, when we became overheated. That is, not during the day, but during the night, trying to sleep.
Because the sweat was in there,
yeah.
It was cold. Well, do I understand that you sewed this underwear on? It was sewn on you for 3 months and not removed for 3 months. Is that correct?
When we sewed our underclothes on when we left the ship, and we kept them on, took the buttons right off and sewed them on with twine and a good big sail needle right on solid. We knew we were never going to undress until we got back. We might be gone 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, a month, 2 months, or 3 months. We didn't know, but we sewed our underclothes on for the trip, and as I did on the North Greenland trip, I sewed my underclothes on knowing I wasn't going to undress. And we lived the same way on the North Greenland trip, gone for about a month, as we did on the Polar Sea.
I'd like to change the subject slightly to that of food. Now, Peary makes very clear the rations you use, which principally is based upon pemmican. We didn't get into this yesterday, but it's a question related to our problem of clothing. The quartermaster is also responsible for food. What was your personal frank reaction to the pemmican ration? Were you satisfied with it? Do you think it's the best one that could have been used? The lightest, the most energy for the lightest weight?
I think we had the perfect food. 8 ounces of pemmican in the morning, never any lunch, for no one cared to stop at 60 below zero and eat. And at night we had another 8 ounces, and we had crackers. Each cracker weighed 1 ounce, and so we could tell exactly how many days we had left on our sledges. So eight little crackers and 8 ounces of frozen pemmican. That was the breakfast, and a good boiling hot cup of tea. Never anything during the day, and at night the same thing. But I may say we were hungry all the time, and we thought of every good thing we ever ate in our lives. But as Peary said, at home we eat twice as much as we ought to anyhow, and that is enough to keep us going. And it did. we were in perfect physical condition on a pound of pemmican, and that's 38% suet, raisins, and sugar, and meat ground up into a red powder mixed with that suet. It's the perfect food, and nothing more. Other expeditions have used a dozen and even 15 things, different articles, on their food supply on their long trips. But I think pemmican and biscuit and boiling tea, that's all anyone ever wants for a trip such as we went on.
Very interesting. I remember yesterday when he first started out, and I first started out to ask you the secrets of your success, the secrets of success of the Peary method. And you began by stressing the importance of the stove. And you made a great point of the efficiency of the stove, that all the heat, it was so designed that all the heat went into the ice and it didn't warm the tent at all. But it was very efficient for that reason, because all the heat went into melting the ice. And I believe you said that it really is true that you succeeded in getting by, the expedition got by, on a ration, a fuel ration of 6 ounces of alcohol per day per man. Is that correct?
That's right. 6 ounces of alcohol for the three men. We were in divisions of three men.
Per day per man or per division of three?
We have, that 6 ounces of alcohol we had for the day, for the three men.
Oh, for the three men, I see.
Yeah, at the end of the march, we built our snow house, this one division. Each division built its own snow house. And we three men were permitted to use 6 ounces of alcohol for the morning meal and for the evening meal. And in the morning, as I said, 8 ounces of pemmican. But I must say one thing I forgot. We did have condensed milk.
Uh-huh.
And we got a little bit out of that. With a hatchet, we'd cut the condensed milk in half, because it's frozen as hard as a rock. We'd cut it in half and drop one half in the teapot. And when it boiled out, we'd fish out the tin, throw it away. And that other half remained for a night. But we cut the tin for the supper time. Then that half was all ready to be used for breakfast. So we used a can of condensed milk a day for three men.
Now I have some other questions here. I'm jumping around a little bit. One question we didn't get into yesterday was, you're on the trail at 1560 below zero under these, with this equipment which you've been describing, and food. How did you answer the call of nature conveniently and efficiently without danger with that clothing? And what did you use?
Well, you know, that was one advantage of using the Union suit.
Well, go ahead.
There was just a slit in the back of it. And so that was one reason why we used a Union suit instead of the regular drawers that come
pieces
up around the waist, yeah. And of course, we were in perfect physical condition, and we utilized most of everything that we ate. We didn't sit down, of course, and read a newspaper. It only took for a few minutes. And that was one of the, perhaps the most, there's one other more disagreeable thing than that. But that was disagreeable enough to get out in a drifting snow and a howling wind at 60 below zero and attend to the calls of nature. But the most disagreeable thing, and we all admitted that, was untangling frozen traces with your teeth and
dog
your hands.
Traces.
Yeah, with the dog traces. Untangling traces. And you can't do it with mittens, and you must do it with your fingers, and it's 60 below zero. And in the morning, the 8 traces would be just frozen into a big ball where the dogs have been winding and winding all night long, and especially when they were eating at night. Now, that was the most disagreeable. Well, we really didn't mind much tending to the calls of nature, but there's one thing which I've never said and never told about in my lectures, is that we're going to leave that snow house and probably never see it again. And generally, we just went inside and attended the calls of nature
inside
on the bed.
I see.
Protection from the snow and the drifting.
I see. You make a hole and cover it up.
Yeah.
I see.
Put it right on the snow bed. Cover hole in the snow bed.
You carry toilet paper with you.
Yeah, right? We carried all carried toilet paper.
Now, I have some other questions. We're considering the possibility of trying to make a collection, a specimen ensemble of actual polar clothing, such as you and Peary used. And I'm wondering, do you know where there is such a collection, a complete ensemble in a museum somewhere?
Yes, I have one here in my museum in Provincetown. The suit that I wore on the North Pole trip is up here in the museum, and on a form.
Is there any other place where there is one? I was thinking whether we could acquire one to have for reference there, where a lot of this clothing work is being done. This cold weather clothing you see is designed. The quartermaster has the responsibility. Of course, much of it we couldn't use carry over directly, but there may be an idea here, a principle there, a device that would stimulate the thinking of designers. One thought occurred to me, is it still possible to have that made? If one of us went to the proper, to the place where you people had it made, would there be any women left who have, who know how to do this and make that?
Oh, yes, they make them every year.
They do?
All the Eskimos of the North, the Polar Eskimos, the Smith Sound Eskimos, are all dressed exactly as we were dressed on the North Pole trip.
Now, just how, where would I go? I flew up there last time we got to the North.
Any of the women.
Anita.
Of course, but I must say that at certain years, there's no one at Ita, and you never know where they are until you get there. They're never 2 years in the same place. It's like if we want to buy something here in town, we wanted to buy a hammer, we'd go to a hardware store.
Yeah.
If you wanted to buy shoes, you go to a shoe store. Well, when they want caribou, they generally go up and camp at Anaratok at Ita, because they can easily, the caribou grounds are accessible.
And this is true today. I know you were in Greenland last summer, weren't you?
If they want polar bears for their new pants, the pants are getting old, they want polar bears, they're liable to go down to Cape York. And if they want eider ducks, and they haven't had any eider ducks' eggs for several years, well, they say, let's go up and live this year and live at Ita. But any woman in the northern tribe, any woman, any housewife, can make you exactly the clothes that we wore on the North Pole trip.
How long would it take her? And if I went there in the summertime, would that be a reasonable time to go to have it done? I'm thinking of doing it myself.
If you could find the polar bear skin for the pants. When you get there, they'll say, yes, we have the skins for the boots. And we have some caribou skins, but we haven't had any polar bears, they might say, for a couple of years.
Well, suppose I got from the Canadian government, it's all restricted by at least in Canada, they take the polar bears, purchased through the Canadian government, let's say a polar bear skin or two, whatever's necessary, and took it with me in my seaplane.
Oh, yes, most any woman can make you a pair of polar bear skin pants in the northern tribe there.
Then it should be a skin in the raw, just a raw polar bear skin.
Yes, just give them the skin.
And she can soften it up and proceed from there, I say.
I have my whole suit right here in this museum, and I think there's a suit of such as we find among the Smith Sound Eskimo down in Swarthmore College.
Oh.
For there's a man, one of the Swarthmore men went with Peary years ago. Oh. Now, Maria Peary must have her father's clothes.
Oh, that's right. She's in Brunswick, isn't she?
She's right there in Brunswick.
Yes, I see. I
and
know.
She knows what became of all of her father's clothes, and he had beautiful clothes. And Matthew Henson, wife, in New York.
Oh, yes.
She must have all of Matt's clothes.
Huh.
And undoubtedly there are clothes exactly like we wore down the American Museum of Natural History in New York City.
Well, again, if I were to go north and do this, would it also help if I took a caribou, if I took a few caribou skins with me, because then they'd have it right with me, they could use what I brought.
Oh, wonderful.
Mm-hmm, I see.
If you can take the skins right with you, I think probably they'll have the skins for the boots.
That they'll have
they're
right
killing
there.
Seals,
yes. All the time.
You see, constantly, winter and summer, and now and then they'll be out of the Puka Barbata, that's the square flipper seal, which is necessary to have that skin for the soles of the boots.
Mm-hmm. I remember your time yesterday.
Yeah, you want that. Yeah, they all agree on that, the Ukchuk skin. Everywhere I go, it's the same. They're looking for Ukchuks for the bottoms of their boots. The common skin doesn't do. But the legs of the boots, of course, they all have.
Well, those I couldn't take to them, but it occurs to me the polar bear and the caribou hide might pick up in Canada and take up through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can trade for their boots, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Generally, the father there, the husband of the house, he has two or three pairs of boots.
I was thinking, if they make one to fit your own, to fit your particular feet, it's somewhat better, isn't it?
Oh, my, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. But I thought you wanted just put them on an exhibition.
Well, I wanted both.
I was
thinking, I was thinking of having a suit at my own expense, have a complete outfit made to fit me, and then bring it back and perhaps use that. But you've mentioned so many places.
When we got up there in 1925, Bird had the Eskimos make him his clothes.
Uh-huh. Any idea what I should plan would cost if I had this done, if I took my own skin with me?
The money is of no value up there anyhow, and it's material. The women want needles and thread and soap.
Still do they?
Yes, they still want to.
We still
see,
help.
Money is of no value. But if you took Danish money, of course, they can use that at the trading store now and buy coffee and tea and sugar.
Uh-huh. But still taking needles and thread? And
they like needles and thread. The women do especially. Plenty of good, strong needles.
How about needles. Tin cans? When I was in Tibet years and years ago, we found that was a thing we should have taken with us. They just value tin cans so highly as containers with their...
Yes, they did like them then, but I think now, where there's a store up there, they have plenty of tin cans.
Yeah. I'm going
but
to...
But if you should go to among the polar Eskimos, of course you could give them kronas, and they can go down to the store and buy tea and coffee and sugar with the Danish kronas at the Danish store. Right up in Inglefield Gulf is where it is now. They've asked them to leave to Thule, you know, or Umanak.
Yes. Yes.
And they're all up in Inglefield Gulf.
Hmm. Well, I think we've
Carnac. It's Carnac is where the new village is. Up in Englefield Gulf. There's a lot of them there. And undoubtedly, most any of those women know how to make polar baskin pants. If you finish the polar baskins.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get those from the Hudson Bay Company, as you know. They have so many they don't know what to do with them. Last mm-hmm. I heard.
I've been asked to ask you two or three questions here. One individual particularly who's working in this problem, I particularly want to know about beards. Did you grow beards or did you not?
No.
And what do you think about that?
We were very careful to keep all beards from the face. And just before we left the ship, Peary told us all to use fine clippers and shave, cut all hair from the head as close as we could with the clippers, for it's under a heavy deerskin cap and you perspire. So we cut our hair with clippers and took clippers with us to keep all hair off of our face, for all the moisture in the breath congeals into ice on the face. And to get a bad frostbite in under a beard would be a pretty serious thing.
Then I have another question, particularly about polar tentage.
Polar what?
Tents. Now, I know you use snow houses on the polar ice.
Yes, we build a snow house every night.
Well, the person asking this question said that according to the book, Peary's book, it took an hour to do that.
With three men.
Three men.
Yeah.
And his thinking is that with modern tents, which erect very quickly, that... It might be possible to, perhaps be better if one of the modern tents, small light tents, would take which would put up 5 or 10 minutes, something like that.
Yeah, there's no comparison between using a tent at 60 below zero in a snow house. Every bit of moisture from your breath clings to the inside of the tent into long ice feathers. And all the condensation from the boiling water from your tea does the same thing. And any little motion in the tent sends that down in a shower on top of you. No, I'd rather sleep without a tent or without a snow house. In fact, than to go into a tent at night. We tried it. It's terrible. Just as soon as it began to get warm, you see, we all went into tents.
Another question that I've been asked to ask you, and that is about the traction on the bottom of the footwear. Now, the square flipper seal you used for the
soles.
Yes. How about the traction? Did it give traction? Did you have all the traction that you wanted? Or
yes, we never noticed, but we could walk better. Well, we could walk better with a soft-soled shoe than we could with a hard-soled shoe. It'd be impossible to walk around on the ice with such as a shoe as you and I are wearing right now.
Mm.
But you can use the muscles of your feet and the muscles of your toes to grip the ice. And we never had any trouble with the Eskimo boot, with the square flipper sole. It's the very best kind of a walking gear, I think.
Well, now, sir, I think we come to this final thing, which is this, if you'd be willing to. If you could just... recall from your memory and just state the procedure that you went through when you prepared yourself to sleep without sleeping bags, prepared your clothing to sleep without sleeping bags. I remember yesterday you started out and I made notes of the things you told me, but I was making notes so fast I couldn't quite keep up. And you started out, I think, with the sleeping, in Alaska we call it muckluck, you have the Eskimo name for it.
Yes, sometimes we did use the chemic puck. We call it a kamik is an Eskimo boot. A kamik puck is a sleeping boot. And sometimes we did pull on those bulky kamik pucks, but it's not necessary to do that. But in cold weather, of course, your feet are more comfortable at 60 and 70 below zero in a kamik puck. So pull on, it's very much like an overshoe, goes on over your regular shoes. We didn't take off our boots at all, but we did take the grass every night out of the boot and dry it over a little lamp and shake the frost out of it. Then knead it back into the bottom of the kamik, put in this sheepskin stocking. We use sheepskin stockings, but preferably the stocking made from the hair of the skin of the polar hare. But I think we had nearly all had sheepskin stockings.
But when you pull on this sleeping,
pull it on and tie it around your leg.
Around the top of the calf, the
leg,
is that it?
Yes, mm-hmm. I think they went up as high as that.
And
that kept our feet warm during the night.
And then going up the body, did you tell me that you had a fox rolls went around your knees? How did...
Yes. You take the tails of two foxes and sew them together and make a ring out of that, a fur ring. And you pull it right on over your foot and up over the calf of your legs and right below your knee. At the termination of the polar baskin pants and the beginning of the kamik, that's the part of the body that's exposed, bare, to 60 and 70 below zero. So we pulled those on windy days and even slept with them on. It's a good idea to have those. protection for the leg.
Then the polar bear skin pants, the knee to the hip, was the polar bear skin pant that you'd been using during the day, and just that. Just nothing more. You just slept with it that way. You'd walk with it during the day.
Yeah, we kept them on for months, for a month, 2 months.
And then from then on, then you came to the point of what we Alaskans call the parka, but you have the other Eskimo, the Greenland Eskimo name is not parka, but you call
it... Oh, kulita.
And you tied, you told me you laced that around the crotch from fore to aft.
That's right. We had a lacing around the bottom of the kulita, and you can reach right down between your legs and tie the ends in front to the loop in the back. Pull it right up tight, and you're in your own sleeping bag.
Then I think you said that for the upper part of your body, you had parkas of which you could pull the hand of the arm inside the sleeve and into your breast, and then you did that with both arms. You pulled the glove into the sleeve, was that it?
That's right.
And then what was the detail about how you put your face into the fur and slept with your breathing into the fur?
I think these kulitas made by the Eskimo women were a little loose around the shoulders, so we had no difficulty at all with just bending our arm and slipping our arm out of the kulita in on our breast. And when both arms are in that, leaves two empty sleeves. Put the mittens in the sleeves in case you need them during the night, in case the house should crack open as it did one night, and two men went drifting away on a cake of ice. And then throw one of the sleeves over the opening in the face. And that opening in the face is fringed with the skins of the Arctic fox. Wolverine, they tell me, is better, but we had no wolverine. We knew nothing about wolverine. But there was a roll of blue fox around the face, and the skin of the sleeve of the coat, or the sleeve of the coat, you might say, covered that opening sufficiently to protect our face as we slept at 60 and 70 below.
Well then, sir, can I ask this question? How long would you sleep? Could you sleep as long as 8 hours, or did you begin to get cold after an hour or two?
We were never cold unless we had been perspiring during the day and our underclothes were damp. But if the underclothes were dry, we had no difficulty in sleeping at all. Peary gave us 7 or 8 hours every night.
Well, I meant to ask first. You did the things we spoke of, and then you laid down on this piece of canvas.
Yes, we put that canvas on the snow. I remember.
Mm-hmm.
I have just a vague recollection of spreading that thing out. But in general, we didn't use it.
And of course, all this was inside the snow house.
This is inside of the snow house. No wind at all, perfectly quiet, you know. And a little round hole in the top to give you air. For the stove, when you're boiling your tea, and we boiled it for 9 minutes, took, of course, oxygen so that two of my Eskimos passed out one day. So we always cut a little round hole in the roof and gave us plenty of air as we slept.
Must have made a lot colder inside.
Yes, I imagine we could have been warmer if the three of us were in there sealed in without any hole in the eagle.
Certainly safer to have a hole.
Yeah, but we always had to take your knife and just clip a hole right out of one of the snow blocks, sometimes right over the door, so if a polar bear came at night, we could watch our dogs and the bear, as one bear came up to the house one night.
If you were caught out without snow houses, or were in a place where the snow was such that you couldn't make a snow house, would you have survived?
I'd go right into a snowbank, as I did twice. Just get on your hands and knees, pick out a nice big snowbank, and begin to paw the snow in front of you, and shove it out between your legs, and work right in and under the snowbank. Then turn around and block up the hole, and you're very comfortable that way. I was caught that way twice.
Because you've got fur on with textile
wet. When you take polar bear skin pants and a good heavy deer skin coat and a good boots, 60 below is all right, even 74 below is all right.
And now if we do it with our clothing, just to belabor this point, to be sure I get everything out of it, if we do something like that with our clothing, with textile clothing, at least my humble experience has been that if you just get into a snowbank like that, you inevitably start melting the snow and it comes through. But is it the case that if you do it with a bear skin...
I never noticed that our bodies ever melted the snow.
Because you had bear skin, had bear skin and deer skin. There's the difference, you think.
I think so.
That's the point, I see.
Mm-hmm. I think with woolen clothes, the heat would have been conducted through into the couch where we were sleeping. But I never noticed we made any impression on that snow bed.
Again, to really try to get the sharp points on this, if you dug into a snowbank like that, to sleep in this manner, would you try to put something under your hips and under your shoulder?
No, we never did.
Points?
Mm-hmm. No, we never did.
The clothing, the fur...
I remember I was caught alone in a blizzard and got on my hands and knees and dug right into a snowbank, pushed the snow out between my legs. And when I got in there where I found it very nice and comfortable, I turned around, made a snow block and stuck it in the door and went sound asleep and had a good sleep.
To stimulate your memories and your thinking in every possible way, you've no doubt read this interesting little story that Stephenson has written about the Eskimo woman, I think it was in Flaxman Island, who was caught. She caught in a blizzard some distance from her home, and she couldn't find her way easily. Anyhow, she decided to spend the night where she was, and he goes into great detail as to exactly how she did it. According to this account, she fell around, of course, she was on ground, she was not on the polar ice, fell around with her feet until she found a little hummock, a little tuft of grass. And then, according to this, she took her mittens off and put them on the tuft of grass and then sat on the mittens and then went to sleep sitting there. The point being, according to this account, the great point of this account being that the pressure point where she was in contact with the ground was, to her, very important, and that's why she took her mittens off and found a place where there's a tuft of grass, took the mittens off, placed them on that, and pulled her hands up inside her parka sleeves. I gather that she was from a different, she was from a part of the north, of northern Canada, for example, where the Eskimo styles of clothing and Eskimo techniques are perhaps slightly different from what they are in Greenland. What would be your reaction to that?
I think it's a fairy story. This looking around to find a little piece of grass and putting your mittens on it. I can't imagine any Eskimo ever doing that. An Eskimo gets tired, he just simply goes to sleep. He doesn't feel around to find a spot of ground and then put his mittens on the ground. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't
well,
get that
anything. Well, that's why I asked the question.
The heat of our body was not conducted through by the snow bed. I don't think we ever felt the snow bed ever melted a quarter of an inch by the heat of our body. The clothes, just like a dog or a polar bear, sleeping in the snow. That was the idea. As Peary often said, if a polar bear can sleep in the snow, we can.
Well, sir, can I stop right there? Because I'm wondering if there's a little point there, possibly. As I understand it, the Eskimos where Stephenson was operating, about which he's writing, used entirely caribou deer clothing, whereas you people used polar bear for your trousers, at least. And I remember yesterday you making a great point about the polar bear fur being so much better for insulating qualities than the deer.
Durable.
Possibly, could that possibly be the reason why your Eskimos and you wouldn't be concerned about whether you sat in a piece of grass or not, to just go ahead and sit in the snow because you wouldn't be bothered with polar bear skin and polar bear fur on? Could that be the difference, you think?
Perhaps it is. There's nothing gets through but a good, nice polar bear skin pants. You can do anything. Slide on your tail down an iceberg and just abuse your pants, but they're right there with you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If I was to do work in the north again, I'd want, for cold, heavy work, I'd want polar bear skin pants. They're so durable, you know. The skin of the caribou is fragile. It breaks. Even when we had tried caribou skin sleeping bags, which I did 1 year, our mouth and nose and eyes are all full of skin, always breaking off, and the bag getting thinner every day in that way.
Changing the subject slightly to one final little point, if we haven't taken too much of your time, I'm thinking of the sledging. In the years since the peripolar parties, of course, all sorts of motor sledges have been improved since those years, and these various tracked vehicles. I'm wondering whether you would think in the present state of that art, these motor track vehicles, whether it would still be true, as you and Peary were sure in those days, that no motor sledge could begin to do on the polar ice pack what the dog teams did. Would you still think that's true, or would you think that modern...
You couldn't use a motor vehicle out on the ice of the polar sea.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the pressure ridges that go 35 feet high, they'd never be able to get over the pressure ridges, and they'd never be able to cross the leads that were just freezing over for a few hours, started to freeze over for a few hours ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you'd lose any kind of a motor vehicle out on the ice of the polar sea. I was the first to use motor vehicles in the north.
You said so?
Yeah, very first. And I was first to use radio, as you know.
Eskimos
predicted that I was going to lose it. But I never did.
Could you tell us a little bit
about...
But
you can go out over the polar sea. That's a different thing. You can run around in the harbors and up and down the coast pretty well.
Uh-huh.
As I did for a year in Labrador.
What was the date of that, sir?
That was 1927.
What sort of vehicles did you have?
I used a Ford snowmobile skis and tractor tread machine.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And it was said all up and down the coast that McMillan was going to be drowned because he would never get across the leads. Before he knew it, going along there, sitting up in that seat, he's going out onto thin ice, and he'll never come back.
I suppose you did it with no top, so in case you did go through, you could jump out, I suppose.
Yeah, we had a little top on it.
Well, you were in clothes,
but I think we could have gotten out all right if we did. But we would never had any trouble. We never lost it. It's up there now. It's up there on the Labrador Coast. But I decided it was absolutely useless for the work that we did in 1989. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You couldn't use motor vehicles out on the rough ice of the Polar Sea. Mm-hmm. Because, principally because of the pressure ridges and the thin ice of the leads. Mm-hmm. You're bound to use it. You're bound to lose it.
Mm-hmm.
There. Because that salt water ice bends like a sheet of rubber. And then we couldn't walk it. Now, the ice is pretty thin when the feet of your dogs are going through at every step. And we saw that one day, little round holes in the ice. Well, the feet of our dogs are going through. It's time to get on your sledge then. Mm-hmm. But a motor vehicle, you see, would be in a very precarious position, you might say.
Mm-hmm. Well, sir, thank you very much indeed. Certainly appreciate your kindness and courtesy in making this information available. Deeply appreciate it. Can you think of anything else that should be added, knowing what our problem is, and realizing, of course, we have Peary's books and your writings, but the thing I wanted to get was, what isn't in the books?
Yes.
And your personal reactions that...
Well, I tell you, I've used the tupik, the Eskimo sealskin tent, and also the snow house, and there's no comparison between the snow house. I want to emphasize that. In cold weather, the snow house is the very best possible shelter. It's almost impossible to live in a tent with it slatting and banging and moisture coming down, snow coming down, icicles coming down. Although you could put it up very quickly, yet in the gale of wind, 40 and 50 below zero, the tent might go off and leave you, as it did with a family of Eskimos, left them lying on the ground. But the snow house, you never know there's a gale. You never know what's going on. Just a murmur, the heaviest kind of weather and the coldest kind of weather. In there, it was just like being in the room right here at home. Very, very comfortable. If our men in the north only knew how to build snow houses.
How long would it take a reasonably intelligent, fairly agile person, adapted...
Oh, I think traveling with an Eskimo in 2 or 3 days,
mm-hmm.
we were all able to build snow houses.
Mm-hmm.
For a shelter, even if you knew enough to build one for a shelter, not a snow wall and covered with a piece of canvas, as has been done by many expeditions.
Mm-hmm.
But most any man traveling with a good Eskimo in 2 or 3 days, he'll build his own snow house.
Well, what do you do about the problem of there not being suitable snow down in Alaska?
That's the problem. Find the suitable kind of snow. You never could build one in this country.
Mm.
It's not compacted enough by the wind.
Mm, windy. It's wind-packed snow that you need.
Yeah, and furthermore, the snow up there is entirely different from what it is here. It's made of little fine, hard pellets of snow. That when it's compacted by the wind, you handle it like a block of wood. It would be impossible to build a snow house of the snow that I've ever seen here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, be impossible. To build it the way they build it, you can get into a snowbank here, digging underneath of it, as I did as a little boy right here in Provincetown. We cut a little round hole in a big snowbank and crawled in, sat there and looked at each other. That was our first igloo. But that's no kind of a house that such as men would want in the north.
Well, sir, thank you very much. We can't think of anything more to add to what's in the book, and particularly these points that aren't in the book.
May I say that I think all men going into the north for a winter time, all should learn to build a snow house. It might save their life. Might save their life. And have that stove that make a gallon of tea in 9 minutes. That's
mm-hmm.
an important thing.
I picked that up yesterday. That's in the book. Rather be.
Well, that's an important thing.
Oh, have you happen to know the patent number of your
improvement? No, I've forgotten it.
But as I understand
it,
you...
get it in Washington.
Yes, what year would that have been presented? How would we look it up in the patent office?
That was after I came back, probably in about 1920, after I came back from the Kakalan trip. I had it patented in Washington.
And what it is, an improvement on the Peary stove.
It was just an improvement on the Peary stove.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Certain features about it, but just a bit. But Peary, I think, got the idea from Nansen.
Mm-hmm.
For in Nansen's book, Farthest North, almost the identical thing. And Peary must have got his idea from Nansen's stove. And then of course, having used the Peary stove during that year and for 4 years afterwards, then I got it patented. It wasn't patented. The patents run out now, but they should be made. Someone should make that stove.
Mm.
For every man who goes north in the wintertime, and it's impossible to get water.
Burns alcohol. Do you have to prime the alcohol when it's as cold as 40 and 50, 60 below zero? What do you do to get alcohol
there? We found out that alcohol wouldn't burn at 60 below zero
mm-hmm.
at all.
So
and we
do?
Tore up paper and built a fire on top
first.
Of the alcohol. Yes.
On top of the what?
On top of the alcohol. Just tear up paper and put it on top of the alcohol. Then touch a match to the paper.
Oh.
And that starts vaporization.
Oh, I see.
Our Eskimos were very much afraid the first night out when we couldn't light our alcohol. Then we took the wrappers off the condensed milk cans and tore them up, sprinkled it on top of the alcohol, set fire to the paper, then the began to vaporize.
Obviously, your alcohol was more efficient than the blubber oil, or you would have taken there, the
ethanol. Oh, yes. There's nothing like that. That's the quickest stove in the world. It'll make a gallon of tea in 9 minutes. Mm-hmm. The primer stove will do it in about 20 minutes.
That takes pressure.
The trouble of the primer stove is the valves. If that valve gets stuck, you're through. And that's a very delicate thing, the valve in the primer stove, which must be kept open.
Oh, and this alcohol stove, is there pressure, or is there no, it's a fairly simple
nothing,
stove.
It's just opened.
Oh, well, that's simplicity. That makes it
no
makes
valves.
It good. Nothing to go
nothing.
Wrong.
Just pour it out into a cup and touch fire to it.
Mm-hmm.
No valves at all.
But it burns without smoke, and you utilize it.
Burns without smoke. And this, it takes all the heat from the burning alcohol, goes into your ice.
Well, there's nothing more that can be done then. That's it.
That's it. Yeah, that's one thing why we disliked it, because it gave us no heat.
Shows how efficient it was.
It all went into, shows how efficient. We all went into our tea, the heat did.
Well, thank you very much, sir.